Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening's event here at the LSE. My name is Kevin Featherstone, and I'm a professor in the European Institute here at the LSE. Tonight's talk is part of the LSE programme on Brexit. We've had a series of lectures, discussions, seminars since the 2016 referendum discussing the implications of Brexit. And tonight, we take the opportunity of looking ahead on the assumption that some kind of Brexit will indeed occur to consider the future implications. And indeed, this evening, to look at the implications in terms of one of Britain's most important bilateral relations within Europe, that is with Germany, a country with which we have very close common interests, whether it's economics, foreign policy, defence, finance, education, whatever, a very close bilateral relationship. So we wish to look indeed at how this relationship may be best sustained on the assumption that some kind of Brexit will indeed be occurring. I should say, of course, that here at the London School of Economics, the relationship with Germany has for many, many years been a very important one, not only in terms of the number of German students that come to the school, but also faculty as well, very distinguished colleagues. So certainly in terms of education, research, the scientific community, many of us would hope that the relationship continues to prosper whatever happens. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, His Excellency Dr. Peter Wittig, who is the German ambassador to the Court of St. James in the UK. The ambassador arrived in July 2018, so he knew what he was coming to. Brexit had already been decided, or possibly not, and he's been ambassador in Washington, ambassador at the United Nations in New York. As a student, he studied history, political science, and law at the universities of Bonn, Freiburg, Canterbury, and Oxford. Sadly, not at the LSE, so we've taken our time to get him to the LSE. We've arranged that he will make a short presentation. We'll then make sure there's plenty of time for questions and discussion afterwards. So, can you please join me in welcoming our speaker this evening, Dr. Peter Wittig.
Dear Professor Featherstone, dear students, LSE community, ladies and gentlemen, it's a true pleasure to speak here at the London School of Economics. I've been here two times before. First time, at the end of the 70s, I visited Ralf Dahrendorf, who was at the time director of the LSE, a much revered German social scientist. And second time last year, when this very brilliant student association of German students, maybe some of them are here, organized their yearly workshop, and it was a pleasure to speak. Well, giving the floor to a German diplomat is always a risky undertaking. I'm not sure if you have heard the story about the Frenchman and the Brit and the German who were asked to each of them write a book about elephants. The Frenchman enthusiastically produces an elephant cookbook. The Brit skillfully writes a collection of very entertaining essays, how to keep an elephant as a pet. And the German, after taking a deep breath, announces that he will write a brief natural history of the evolution of the elephant from the Ice Age to today, for 5 volumes, 1,000 footnotes. So I promise I will not give a speech 5 volumes, but it might take a little longer than anticipated, maybe 20 minutes. The diplomatic service has been very kind to me. You mentioned I had a couple of post-ambassadorial posts, five in all, where I could represent the interests of my countries abroad. And the, especially the last three posts I had as ambassador, in a way, represent three major dimensions of German foreign policy in at the United Nations in New York, in Washington, and here. The first of the Germany's integration into the multilateral order, then in Washington, the transatlantic relations key, and I will delve a little bit into that transatlantic dimension because it's also important for the state of affairs in Europe. And then, of course, London in the age or times of Brexit and this major challenge to the European Union. And I would speak a little bit about my sort of lessons I take from my time in Washington and then go on to delve a little bit deeper on this relationship between the UK and the European Union in the future. On both postings, Washington and London, I have experienced really a defining moment in our contemporary history. In a way, 2016 was a pivotal year in contemporary history. In Washington, the end of the old Western transatlantic order as we knew it, with the U.S. as the undisputed leader. And in here, as in an unprecedented test for the European Union through the imminent withdrawal of the United Kingdom, the world's fifth largest economy. So to me and to you all, of course, one thing is clear. Europe faces enormous challenges. And I am no prophet of doom and gloom, so in every crisis also lies an opportunity. First, let me make some remarks on the transatlantic relationship. One day in my professional life, I will certainly never forget the 8th of November in 2016, the day Donald Trump won the election as the 45th president of the United States. And during the election night, it was quickly clear to me and my colleagues there that this result was the equivalent of a political earthquake. And the transatlantic relationship between Europe and the United States was at a turning point. The global order, the transatlantic relationship with Europe, and also the attitude of the US government towards Germany, my own country, all have undergone major changes since Trump took office. I see three key developments at work. And President Trump is not always the direct cause. At times, he has acted more as a catalyst. They are, those developments, in a way, three megatrends. First, a progressive retrenchment, a withdrawal by the U.S. from its role as the great champion of the rule-based international global order, retrenchment as a policeman, and as the leader of the West. It's true that Obama was already keen to end America's two great wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he wanted as much as possible to avoid future military entanglements, for example, in the Middle East. So in this, to this extent, there was a certain continuity, but Trump's break with Obama and with all his Republican predecessors since 1945 lies in abandoning the claim to political, moral leadership of the West. So the institutions of the liberal world order, which the U.S. itself had created or promoted, are less valued by the Trump administration, be it the United Nations, the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Trade Organization, NATO, and even the European Union. And according to America First, the world is seen as an arena in which national interests collide and the stronger country wins with whichever alliance is convenient at the time. America as a European, and this is, I think, the sober insight that we have to realize, America as a European power is fading. Indeed, the EU is sometimes seen more as a rival than an ally. Second megatrend that I see is the break with the open, free, rule-based economic and trade order. This is most clearly seen in the trade conflicts, or some would say trade wars, which have been broken out under President Trump. But this development reflects a broad groundswell in many parts of the US. It's not just a Trump and Republican development. This is shared, or this is a sentiment, a groundswell that is also deeply ingrained into the Democratic Party. Some of Trump's protectionist measures may be tactically motivated, the art of the deal, but we shouldn't be deceived. A simple return to the old WTO order is unlikely. At the same time, we need to accept that the WTO, also the Bretton Woods institutions, are getting rather elderly. They need reform and modernization. So we Europeans should see this as a restructuring job to be undertaken together with the US and others, such as Japan. More than most other countries, my own country, Germany, is an export-oriented economy, and it has a vital interest in maintaining a rule-based global economic and free trade order. And the third mega trend, which ought really definitely concern us Europeans, is America's fixation with China. China is seen as the strategic rival in the future bipolar order. And in fact, this highly critical view of China is shared by most US Democrats as well. Russia may be a thorn in the eye of the US Congress and is the preferred target for ever new sanctions, but it's certainly not seen as a peer to the US in the future. India seems hardly on the US radar. The real strategic opponent is China, geopolitically, economically, and perhaps one day also militarily, at least in the Pacific, where in the longer term, China is hardly going to be happy with second place. So one sober consideration, one conclusion is inescapable. As far as this US administration is concerned, Europe will in future no longer be a key player in world politics. So the question for us is, what, other than just being passive spectators, what should we do? These developments affect vital and German and European interests. For this reason, we must recalibrate the transatlantic partnership with the US, which is so central for us, in order to be able to renew it and to enforce it. And I'll just mention a few aspects of this. We Europeans, and this applies especially to Germany, must assume more responsibility for our own security. This includes, in particular, strengthening the European pillar of NATO. And the times when we Germans and Europeans could automatically rely on America to safeguard our security interests, they are over. To avoid any misunderstanding, I'm not arguing for a break with the United States or for a new equidistance equivalence in relation to other great powers. We Germans know better than anybody. Without America, there would not have been a NATO, a European Union, no reunification, in short, no peace in Europe. We should continue to cooperate closely with the US in areas where we have overlapping economic, political, and security interests. For example, in some aspects of our relations with China and Russia, or in resolving the great political crises as in Syria or North Korea or the Middle East. But where our core interests are at stake, for example, in trade matters or one example. And in our policy towards Iran, we must unequivocally defend our common European position and also make it publicly clear. And we should never stop reaching out to and engaging with American society in all its geographic and social diversity, and investing in the broad foundation of our partnership of common values. At the end of the day, no two regions in the world are closer to each other than North America and Europe. And let's not forget, America is bigger than one president. And now to Europe in times of Brexit. A little over a year ago, I moved to London, and you refer to it from one political drama to the next. Ever since, I've been mesmerized by British politics, divided and strained, and of course deeply preoccupied by the future of Europe without Britain. The United Kingdom and Europe are standing, as I see it, at a historic crossroads. Quickly, it became clear to me that Brexit is not just due to a passing whim on the part of the voters. Many factors came together in the referendum vote of 2016, and I don't have to enumerate and list them. You know that as well as I do. What the negotiating marathon of over 2 years has, in my view, shown is that the 2016 referendum, above all, settled the question of whether to leave the EU, and it did not settle the question of how. For the European Union, which has remained remarkably united throughout the Brexit process, there have always been two principles. First, the Good Friday Agreement, which 20 years ago brought a precarious peace to Northern Ireland and put an end to the terror. And the principle was the Good Friday Agreement must not be put at risk. And second, the single market of the European Union must be effectively protected. And against the expectations of many, agreement on a deal was reached, first with Theresa May, and now, a couple of weeks ago, almost a small miracle, mid of October, with Boris Johnson. A majority in the House of Commons has rejected the Theresa May deal three times, but has recently seemed in reach in the House of Commons. Of course, the general election on the 12th of December offers the possibility that the Brexit withdrawal agreement negotiated with the European Union can be got over the line, but we are, of course, in the hands of the voters either way. In the last few weeks, we have witnessed a general constitutional crisis in this country, a near collapse of the fundamental democratic consensus. Two constitutional organs have collided, government and parliament. The referendum vote for Brexit, which Johnson sees as decisive, so to speak, the sovereignty of the people, is in direct conflict with sovereignty of parliament, which lies at the heart of the unwritten British constitution. For Europe, and especially for Germany, Brexit is a regrettable development. Economically, in our view, it's a lose-lose game. After all, the UK is one of Germany's top five trading partners. Politically, too, it changes the power configuration in Europe. Brexit would mean we lose an important and often like-minded partner. So there is also a risk, and this is probably something that moves me, in particular, a risk that our societies are drifting apart. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's leave behind current concerns for a moment and cast our eyes into the future. Let's take a strategic look where we are. Where will Europe be in 10, 15, or 20 years? Will it still be sitting at the table of the great powers? Will Europe still be on the global map as an economic, political, military, technological power? Seen from this perspective, a hard Brexit, a hard Brexit must seem to us not just as a temporary weakening of the UK and of the European Union, but as a strategic error of the first order. If it is possible to achieve a close future relationship between Britain and the EU, the shocks of a hard Brexit and weakening of Europe could be greatly mitigated. During the agreed transition period, the foundations could be laid for a new special relationship between the European Union and the UK through a favorable, advantageous free trade agreement, through agreements on close foreign and security cooperation, and through fruitful partnerships in the area of science, research, and universities. Programs like Erasmus or Erasmus Plus or Horizon 2020 should be possible to be continued to enable future exchange in higher education and science. And this is not just about strengthening Europe as a research and innovation powerhouse in the world of tomorrow. It's about ensuring young people can experience Europe as an enabler, as a force for good in their own lives. To think that Britain's exit from Europe is the end of the Brexit story is a mistake. This is where the hard work on the future relationship really begins. In foreign and security policy, consultation formats need to be found which are commensurate with the role and weight of the UK. A free trade agreement between EU and UK must be concluded during the transition phase after Brexit, which ensures trade is as smooth as possible, yet at the same time prevents a race to the bottom in standards. This is one big building site. I will conclude with a few thoughts on the future of Europe. The year 2016 represented a pivotal watershed in European history. It will go down in the history books. Brexit and the election of Donald Trump were loud wake-up calls for the European Union. Old certainties have vanished. Brexit profoundly altered and will alter the power relations in the European Union. And at the same time, Brexit reflects many fears and anxieties which exist all over Europe. The Atlantic is getting wider. The West has lost its main leadership figure. The world has become a little bit like a house without guardian. Democracies seem to be in retreat. Populism and authoritarian regimes seem to be on the march. Our Western and European order is more endangered than many are willing to see. In winter 2019, the European Union stands at the beginning of a new mandate, a new legislative period. The time is favorable for a far-reaching debate on the future of Europe. And we need it urgently. Essentially, it should revolve around three great questions. How can we win citizens over again to the European idea of defending and securing peace? What powers do Europe's institutions need in order to play their part in shaping global challenges? And how can we create a greater democratic legitimacy, which not only inspires citizens with trust and confidence in the European Union, but enables them to feel ownership in the European Union? This debate cannot be just airy theorizing. The citizens are demanding convincing answers to urgent questions. And I will mention some key issues on which I believe the new EU leadership under the helm of Ursula von der Leyen and the new Council President, Mr. Michel, should focus. In immigration and asylum policy, the legal harmonization and above all, effective protection of Europe's external borders. The building of a more competitive Europe with more closely aligned fiscal policy in the European Union member states. The creation of a defense union. The strengthening of the European research and innovation in a world of global competition. A single digital market worthy of the name, and a pioneering role for Europe in global climate protection. Germany and France have a special responsibility when it comes to shaping a European reform agenda. Obviously, not by themselves. This is a collective task for all in the European Union. Paris and Berlin often come from very different starting points. But when they agree, the chances of an overall EU agreement are good, or at least better. What's more, in 2020, next year, Germany will hold the EU presidency with a special responsibility, but also with special opportunities for shaping this process. At the same time, realism is advisable. I say this as a practitioner and a pragmatist. Bold reforms of a big bang nature through far-reaching changes to the European treaties are not likely to happen in the next few years, if only because the widespread wish among member states to avoid a controversial ratification process, including referendums in some countries. The necessary debate will not bear fruit overnight. The EU is a supertanker, not a speedboat. 27, in future 27, sovereign states have to agree, and this is always hard work. But with a new leadership team, who are also strong communicators with the European citizens, we have a good starting point and a good starting position. Yet, sleepwalking in the crisis that we are going through, that's just what Europe cannot afford anymore. But revitalizing Europe is not just a matter for governments and parliamentarians. It is, above all, also a matter for society as a whole, the citizens themselves. We must all play our part, work, campaign, sometimes struggle, in order to make the EU ready for the future. If we succeed, Europe will, after all, retain an important place on the global map, not just as an economic and political power, but as a stronghold of our values of freedom, democracy, the rule of law, and protecting the environment. Perhaps even as a beacon, once more, that sends its light into the world. For all of us citizens, the future of Europe, at least to some extent, is in our own hands. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ambassador, very much indeed for that comprehensive overview. Let me start by asking one or two questions in a relatively short conversation, if I may, and then I'm going to open it up to everyone here. Let's begin with what the British talk about most these days, Brexit. Friday the 13th of December, interestingly, Friday the 13th of December, we're either going to wake up to a government which has got a strong overall majority, the opinion polls suggest a Conservative government pursuing the current agreement, but in the election campaign this week, the current Prime Minister has said that he would not be seeking an extension beyond December 2020 in the negotiations for the future relationship. There's obviously something of a question mark over that projection, the realism of that scenario. or alternatively on Friday the 13th, we'll wake up to a parliament with no overall majority, conceivably an alternative government which would like to see an alternative withdrawal agreement and political declaration. In the latter scenario, a new British government wishing to see a different kind of withdrawal agreement and a different kind of long-term plan for the UK-EU relationship, would the German government say, yes, okay, let's talk? Or would the German government repeat the mantra that we've heard in recent weeks to say that, no, there's no further negotiation?
Well, first of all, the European Union has proved to be firm on principles, and I mentioned those two principles, no hard border on the island of Ireland.
Yep.
That means preserving, salvaging the Belfast Agreement, and the second principle was protecting the single market of the European Union. But so within that framework, the European Union has proved to be rather flexible in the negotiations, and you know the testimony is this deal that could be concluded with Boris Johnson's government, which many thought would not happen, but it happened also because the UK moved quite a bit. So we are dealing with governments, and whoever will be the next prime minister, of course, the European Union, the leaders, the 27, will deal with him or her. Let's not exclude the Liberals here. The leader of the Liberals said she is a candidate for prime minister. So we will deal with the next prime minister. If this current government carries the day, then it's very likely that this existing deal will, you know, if the majority is sufficient, will pass Parliament, and then we enter at the end of January into that transition period. And you mentioned that it's a short transition period. It's just an 11 month until the end of 2020. There is this possibility to extend that transition period up to 2 years. It's a tall order. So the list of tasks for this transition period is long, and I specified the assignments. It is a very ambitious endeavor to come to a free trade agreement.
But if a Corbyn government was elected and said, we'd like to reopen things, we're rather interested in the Norway model, that's not off the agenda.
Well, I mean, of course, I cannot speak for the 27 governments, but we will deal with any government, and if the government, the next government says we want to have a much closer relationship with the European Union, then I assume the European leaders would look at that with a benevolent eye, so to speak, again, without preempting anything that they might do. There is a certain fatigue, of course, not only in this country, Brexit fatigue, but also in the circles of governments and also in the public opinion. But maybe I can highlight a little bit the German approach here. We've been probably one of the countries that showed, you know, a sense of pragmatism in those negotiations, and we've been patient, and I think we would explore every opportunity to salvage and protect a close relationship with the UK, with or without Brexit, and that's in our national interest. And as we see, and I also mentioned, so as we see the strategic way forward. And I think this is always useful to extract oneself a little bit out of this day-to-day din. If you look at where Europe, where we want Europe to be in 10 years, we should not commit errors here in a short-term thinking.
I mean, if we want to keep Europe on the global map, we have to stay together in the yes. same orbit.
You mentioned quite a lot about leadership. I'm just going to ask two more questions before inviting the audience to contribute. It strikes me that the rest of Europe is waiting for German leadership, or is trying to interpret German leadership. As you know, have a particular interest in Greece and the recent debt crisis, but also with Brexit now. There seem to be a number of your European partners that look at Berlin and simply misunderstand you. Our current Prime Minister was emphasizing in the 2016 referendum campaign that he was confident that Germany would be very flexible, would do a deal, would concede because German car manufacturers wanted to export to the UK, Italians wanted to export Prosecco and whatever. In Greece, there was, I guess, the sense of a kind of good cop, bad cop with Angela Merkel and the then Wolfgang Schäuble as the minister. So I just wonder, why is it, do you think, that in Europe of the recent past, Germany's partners have looked to Berlin for leadership and have fundamentally misunderstood you, which way you would jump?
Well, you know certainly this moniker, the reluctant hegemon. And I think there's some truth in that. We have now also a so-called grand coalition. Out of the 14 last years, we had 10 years of a grand coalition, which leads to a sort of fatigue with the grand coalition. And it's natural, so if this center-left and center-right big parties have to come together, they are sometimes not as nimble. Again, here I use the word speedboat, but they have to be satisfied with compromise. And you can see this also in European politics.
I can certainly understand that coalition governments give a kind of constructive ambiguity, but Chancellor Merkel and Wolfgang Schäuble were of the same party, and I just wonder why is it that people somehow misunderstand Germany's preferences?
Well, I mean, in this case, I think in the end, the decision was taken to keep Greece in the Eurozone because we wanted to salvage and protect the European house.
Okay.
And, you know, that is our home. And this is something that is probably goes to the differences between a country like Germany, a continental European country, and the UK. They have different histories. I mean, you remember Winston Churchill's speech in Zurich, the United States of Europe, that he called for. Of course, not all people know that. He would not include the UK in the United States of Europe. He would say the UK, of course, has to stay outside as a moderator, as a sort of benign power that sort of protects the balance. In our case, Germany, for us, Europe was and is still a kind of a peace project, a political project. It's basically a political project beyond an economic project. So in the end, we will always say, let's protect the European Union as a strong framework for us and for the 27. I emphasize that because there are now models, again, saying we have to organize ourselves in different circles,
yes.
orbits, at different speed and geometry variable, variable geometry, etc. And the Germans always say,
okay, let's think about it. But, you know, this leads to centrifugal forces that we cannot maybe contain anymore. So, I mean, the Germans, I think, feel an inclination. They don't want to loosen that framework.
Last question from me. In terms of, you refer to building the European house, and I guess Europe has heard President Macron, particularly in his speech at the Sorbonne in September 2017, talk about his vision for Europe, etc. And we've heard the French president repeat this vision for Europe repeatedly. We don't seem to have an equivalent, a vision from Germany, so crystallized as that. And indeed, so much of the coverage seems to be waiting to see how much of that agenda Germany is prepared to accept. If we talk about Eurozone reform, these last few days, we've heard the speech by Olaf Scholz, the finance minister, about the completing the European Banking Union for Eurozone reform. Just to take one example, we seem to be waiting to hear how much of the Macron agenda or how much of any vision for the future of building the European house Germany would, the current German government would sign up to.
Well, I would say, although Germany is sometimes seen as a stereotype, as the country of poets and thinkers and dreamers, in the end, we are not good in the vision thing. You know, Helmut Schmidt said, you know, he who has visions should go and see a doctor. I mean, I guess, you know, we are probably more a little bit of sort of matter of fact people, and we are close to the British in that regard. I think we owe something and quite a lot to Macron because he's driving a reform agenda, which is important. And I think many people in Europe have a desire to know where we are headed. Some people in this grand coalition are more sympathetic to Macron's ideas than others, like who are fiscally more conservative. So there is this, you know, problem in a grand coalition. But I think the mainstream here of German thinking is probably the delivery. How can you deliver reforms in a framework of 27 very different countries? And it's, again, here it's applaudable if somebody stakes out what's at stake here and presents bold initiatives. And the second question, of course, should be, you know, can we deliver? Can we come to an agreement? And so those two approaches have to be brought together. Okay. And maybe that's not such a bad idea to have Germany and France here together. I wouldn't call it a leadership team because that does not justice to everybody else. And I think this needs to be emphasized when so much focus is either on Germany or France. You know, this is a collective endeavor. And I think I sometimes, I mean, I served as a member of cabinet for legendary foreign minister Genscher at the time. So his motto was always, let's never forget small and medium-sized countries in Europe. They are the greatest number. They are the strength. And so we should always include them. So the idea of France and Germany just imposing something is not good for Europe.